Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Let's begin by introducing ourselves. My name's Paul.
Will.
Paul.
Carl.
My name is Jim.
I'm Thomas.
Michael.
Cass.
George.
Carl.
Mark.
Peter.
Clint.
Jim.
Bob.
Snake.
Steve.
Mark.
Peter.
Dave.
Byron.
And you here for the first time, Kurt?
Yes.
Is anybody else here for the first time? Hey, welcome. Our speaker today is a familiar speaker to Roger, and forgot to ask him what his topic is, but I'm sure he'll introduce it. Okay, thank you.
Yes, I did actually let somebody know what it was, but didn't get on to whatever it was supposed to get. when you listen to classical music stations, they will sometimes say today is the birthday of somebody, but you know they've been long dead, so you wonder how they can have a birthday. Apparently it's the birthday they would have if they were still living. So today is in the same sense the birthday of my father. If he was still living, he'd be 103. He didn't quite make it, he died at 1 month short of 98. But since it is the birthday of my father, I thought it would be appropriate for me to speak of the Buddhist attitude towards parents, something which many of us, especially in the gay community, wish we didn't have, but apparently we can't do without them. So we can't do with them, we can't do without them. So I will start off with maybe what is the bad news, and then I will try to go to something that we can use. It's not too well known in the West that Buddhism is quite firm on devotion to parents. It's something which, if you brought up in Asia, you're very familiar with it. But in the West, we think of Buddhism as you just meditate and you go off somewhere, I think. And the notion that you would be very, very devoted to your parents doesn't seem to get onto the radar screen. But it is important, and there are a number of sermons of the Buddha, which address the issue of having respect for parents and what parents were to do to children. The topic is not too complicated, so I think I can get to pretty quickly. It's not a very highly metaphysical issue, as some aspects of Buddhism are. It picks up on the traditional Indian subcontinent tradition of the worship of the deities in the six directions. Sometimes they speak of the ten directions, sometimes of the six. It seems to be the ten is a something later. Things go in twos, fours, six, eight, sixteens, 32s, and then they suddenly go into 10. Something happened with the counting system. It seemed to go from a base 2 to a base 10 for some reason. We don't know quite why. So the six directions, in putting them in the English way of doing, in the Western way of doing things, would be north, south, east, west, and then up and down. When you want the 10 directions, you add in the intermediate ones. I don't know quite why it is in the West that we go north, south, east, west, we go opposite. Maybe it's something to do with our dualistic approach to life. In India and China, they think of themselves as making a circle around. So you go from east to south to west, and then to the north. The tradition is the same in China. I don't know whether there's a connection or whether it's developed independently. It could be Buddhist influence in China. Then you go down to the nadir and then to the zenith. And you will still see this in India today. I was going along on a train in the middle of summer in India, and the trains in India sometimes go and sometimes they don't go so much, and they stop for a bit, you can look around, and that was early morning, and a lady came out of her hut and began to bow in different directions, and there wasn't anything there to bow to, and I said, oh, worship of the six directions, it's still going on. And they're often said to be deities at these six directions. The Buddhist texts do is, as we would say today, is to demythologize that, take away the deities aspect, although of course it doesn't take away deities in general, but Buddhism is not shy about mentioning deities. There are hundreds and thousands of them, but they're rather dumb. They don't have very happy but they're not too fortunate. But it reframes it this way. Bowing to the east is to honor our parents. Bowing to the south is to honor our teachers. Bowing to the west is to honor our wife and children. This is obviously addressed to heterosexual male, right? A surprise. Bowing to the north is to honor our friends and relatives. Bowing to the nadir, to underneath, is to honor the servants, or slaves, as they would have been back then. And bowing to the zenith is to honor the monks and nuns and all the holy men that you find going around India, those who have left the family life to search for the ultimate. Each of these six directions comes with five obligations which are reciprocal, from the parents to the children, children to the parents, and so forth. And I will not go into all of the six, just go into the parents one. The child, when he or she is honoring their parent, is to say things like, as I was supported by them, so I shall support them. I will perform the obligations that I have towards them. I will keep up or preserve the family lineage. This means to get married and continue the family line, something which is important in America in the South. You have to know who your daddy is, yes? But it conflicts, of course, with the notion of becoming a monk or nun. But let us remember that the majority of Buddhists have always been lay people, and it's only been focused on the practice of the monks and nuns for purposes of trying to see it goes further than that. And translation I had, I didn't have time to work out what it was behind that, because I was really late at night, and I didn't have the heart to open my Pali dictionary at that time. It says, I will follow out the family inheritance. I think that means that I will continue in the tradition of our family. which of course within Indian tradition would be important. And then at the proper time I will perform the worship of the dead, of the ancestors. Of, it says actually, it chooses the word Peta, which becomes in later Buddhism, the Peta or Preta becomes a kind of ghost, a kind of hungry ghost, but in early Buddhism it's still retaining the earlier sort of Vedic idea of the ancestors. So you're going to be looking, you're going to be responding to your parents with love and devotion while they are alive. Continue what they're at, not what they've been doing, not say, well, you were just all wrong and I'm going my own way. And then to keep up their memory after death. Then also the parents have an obligation to the children. They are to convert evil, that's to say, stop them from doing the bad things, to set forth good, and teach them a trade or skill. This was before there was, of course, universal education, so it was done largely in the home. At the proper time, they were to wed the boy to a suitable wife. Once again, it's addressed to the man, right? And that was in, this is in the days when marriages were arranged by the parents, which is often still the case in India and China. And at the opportune time, to give the inheritance to the child. Now, these are all pretty ordinary things. Nothing of these surprises. They are a culture bound. But when taken in context of the other references to the teachers and whatever, it reminds us that we're not on our own. We didn't get here on our own. It reminds us of the teaching of the interdependence of everything, or the interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. And it's something I think we need, especially in the USA, because we tend to feel that you're a real American, especially a real man, if you do everything yourself. If you need any help, you're weak. And of course, this is quite nonsense. We couldn't do anything if we didn't have help. We couldn't be in this room without everybody arranging it and people arranging. Someone is working to produce the electricity and so on. Everything is interdependent, and we are in the web of the giving and taking of all beings. So it is helpful to think of our parents in this way. Some of the things they list there we might not feel are too appropriate to us today, but if we have some respect for the parents, we would not simply go our own way without discussing it, I think. We don't really have the tradition that you have to keep on the family line and the tradition of the family, but it certainly makes the parents feel happy if they can be proud of what the son or daughter is up to. And this is nothing. According to the text, this is an integral part of practice of everyday life in Buddhism. It's not something that is to be assigned some other thing. Well, it isn't. If you practice Buddhism, you don't do this. You go off on your own. You're not part of your parental lineage. That is not the traditional teaching. Then, when that's the traditional teaching that you would find in the Theravada tradition, out of the Pali texts. Then it goes, when it goes into China, it picks up on Confucianism. Whenever Buddhism goes into a culture, it modifies the culture and is modified by it. I think what's happening in this culture in the U.S., it's having its most effective interaction with psychology, because when we don't feel too good in the U.S. today, we might go to a priest, minister, or rabbi, but in general we go to a shrink, and we pay them a lot of money for them to say, So how do you feel about that? And somehow or other, this system seems to work. I don't know how. I mean, I've used it myself, and it works, and it didn't work any other way, so I don't understand it, but it does. So then Buddhism in the U.S. is being presented as a kind of psychotherapy which goes beyond general psychotherapy. And then we can say, oh, well, I like that. I don't want a religion, some people in America say. We have enough of those. I want something different. I want to be helped. And so Buddhism says, okay, well, if you like psychotherapy, we've got that. But we can go further. So it goes in to China, and there is... China doesn't have religions, really. It has traditions. The word Jiao means something passed on from father to son in the lineage. They had to make up a word that means religion in the Western tradition, and they took two words that didn't mean anything like it and pushed them together, and they got a word that, in the dictionary, is religion. But the Jiao, the tradition, is traditions which can be broadly identified as Confucian or Taoist, and then subsequently as a Buddhist, or something called folk religion, which means we don't know what to do with it, so we call it folk. These divisions are only a very limited usefulness. They're not in any sense fixed religions. The notion that there was Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism as the three religions in China was something that was a mistake of the Christian missionaries, I think, because they looked for something like the Christian organization of a church, and then they thought they found these three things. These are Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, and folk, if you like. They're kind of modes of acting in China, and people don't generally identify themselves as being a Confucian, a Taoist, or even a Buddhist, or certainly not a focused. It's just one thing that you do. But Confucianism, I'm more happy to put it this way, Confucian tradition, if we see the Chinese worldview as yin and yang, it functions basically on the notion of the complementaries of the yin, or darkness, and the yang, and the brightness, yin internal, yang external, then the yang aspect, the aspect in public life, in everyday reality, in the home, in the running of the home, in the running of the government, this is where the Confucian texts are honored the most. And Confucianism has a lot to say about the ancestor or the parents. And it is pretty absolute. The tradition was, perfectly simply, that because our parents gave us our life, that we would not exist at all unless our parents had had sex, had been present and had sex. Unless that had happened, we would not exist at all. Therefore, we owe everything to our parents, and we can never repay them. This strikes us sometimes a little bit odd, because even if we're not Christian or Jewish or Muslim, we still think that maybe the only entity that could have this kind of absolute power over us would be God, because we all come from God, kind of thing. Well, there's no such entity in a traditional Chinese worldview, so that isn't an option for the Chinese in ancient China. the ancestor, the patriarch, the mother and father, when a mother dies, it was a requirement that the son should go into mourning for 3 years because the mother had suckled him at her breast for 3 years. There is no loss like that of the loss of the mother. Once again, this reminds me of when I lived in the South. You know, when people that live in the South, when they meet each other, they don't say, "Hey, how are you?" They say, "Hey, how's your mama?" And they go from there. And because the mother is the source of our life. It makes sense if you stop and think about it a moment. The father, then, especially the patriarch of the clan, because in a sense he was the source of life for the whole of the clan, it was a sperm that was the source of the life for the whole of the clan. I think in some traditions, the ancestor's ashes would be kept under the bed of the current generation, so the force of the ancestor could assist the production of children. So the patriarch had the power of life or death over the children. They gave you life so they could kill you. And if you did what you shouldn't have done, there was, at that time there were no police, you see, you were referred to the ancestor of the patriarch of the clan, and he would decide what the punishment was, up to and including execution. And it wasn't thought to be odd. In fact, it was said specifically in the Confucian text that even if your mother or your father abuses you and beats you and gives you all the worst stuff to do and never recognizes you, still you must have devotion to them, because still nevertheless they gave you life, even though they're doing this to you. You cannot repay that. There's no possible way you can repay that. So when I'm being mean and I'm talking to a person who is very devoted to Confucianism, I sometimes say, you know, Confucianism takes the dysfunctional family and enlarges it into cosmic proportions. But now the Buddhists picked up on the same thing. And last year, at the time of the birthday of the Buddha, I went to the birthday of the Buddha celebrations at the fairly new Chinese monastery that's been built here in Lafayette. It's an addition from a rather strict Chan or Zen monastery in the middle of Taiwan. And they've come over here with quite traditional teachings in regard to Chan. Most Chinese temples today go back to the tradition in the Song Dynasty, where you mix and match bits of Chan and reciting Buddha's name and bits of Tantra and whatever. But there seems to be now a reform movement, which I don't thoroughly understand. There are books on it now, and I just haven't had a chance to get around to reading them, that there's now a focus more on specific lineages, which up to now has been a phenomenon more of Buddhism in Japan. Well, this is a Chan lineage, but they're very traditional. So on the birthday of the Buddha, we went and we poured water over the baby Buddha statue, as you do all over the Buddhist world. But then we recited the sutra, as spoken by the Buddha on the profound kindness of parents and the difficulty in repaying them. Extremely heavy difficulty of repaying. To pay back is an extremely heavy difficulty, very, very difficult. And the place was filled with Chinese. There weren't a lot of us Westerners there. And we recited this whole thing in Chinese, went on for a long, long time. And I don't have the time, you'll be glad to know, to go into all of it. But the Buddha is going along and sees a pile of bones and begins to weep and says, well, these were all our ancestors of former generations, and now look, they've turned to bone, and we have to pay them honor because of all that happened. And then they, just to cut to the, some of the essences of this, the sutra has the Buddha recite, these are the agonies of the mother. It focuses on the problem of the mother here, because she is the one who has to bear the child, and there is a their understanding in the ancient China about, which comes from ancient India this time, of what the embryo was like is not what we'd have today. But in any case, they do have the same idea that at the beginning, the embryo is very fragile and the mother is protecting it. And we were once a little cell. I mean, all of us here were little blastocysts. Look at us now, we've survived, right? So something happened. And then she bears this woman, she gets fat and ugly, and she has to wear different clothes, and she can hardly move around, but she still does it, because, and then she gives pain in her birth, she gives pain, it's very painful, and then she forgets about all that, and she looks after the child, and she keeps the child, her child warm when she's cold, and dry when she's damp, and so forth. I could list all of them here, but I won't, but they list 10, the sutra, which is supposedly spoken by the Buddha, lists the 10 agonies of the mother. It then goes into detail about all of the 10 agonies, and the sutra keeps on going, as you can see. Then it says, how do we repay all of this? And it starts off with things like this. If a person were to carry his father on his left shoulder and his mother on his right shoulder until their weight bore through his skin to the bone and through the bone to the marrow, and if that person were to circumambulate Mount Sumeru, that's the cosmic mountain, that's very, very, very big. It takes a long time to go around, hundreds of years to go around. If he were to do this with his father and mother on his shoulders, for 1,000 kalpas, a kalpa is hundreds of thousands of years long, until the blood that flowed from his feet, because he's walking bare feet, covered his ankles, that person would still not have repaid the deep kindness of his parents. And a number of things like this, it's just as graphic as all of that. You give, they're starving, so you cut your body into bits to feed them, and do it for hundreds of thousands of years, and still you're not repaying it. You may have seen, when you go around Chinatown, sometimes a little statuette of a young woman and an old woman. And at first you can't see what's happening, but the older woman is suckling at the breast of the younger woman. What's happening here is, this is her mother. The daughter is holding her mother, who has no teeth anymore, and she can't eat. And so the mother is able to give milk to her children, and so she gives milk back to her mother in this way, the perfect altar. So the only way to help all of this is, first of all, to write out the sutra and have it published. They always say that. If you do a lot of writing of sutras, so I think if you have some shares in Xerox, you do quite well. And then you do all kinds of acts of good kindness to all beings. So then in the Tibetan tradition, this is transformed a little bit by the observation that because of rebirth, which has been going on since beginningless time, we have had all creatures as our mothers. And so we think of all beings as our mothers. We think of ourselves as surrounded. All of you are my mother. I found that a bit unnerving at first. but it's not because you're my mother and saying, well, now well, you know very well, do so and so, but because they have nurtured me. You have all nurtured me in the past. You've also been my children, and I've been your mother. And so I think it's from this way that we can then reframe all of this to us, especially if we've had a problem with our biological families, as I didn't have as many problems with my biological family as many did, because I just left. England, and at that time there wasn't much phone and so forth in the 60s. So my mother was very very economical, so she couldn't write much on one page of these little aerogram letters, which she said, "I want one once a week." So I would do this, but we couldn't have big arguments that way. There wasn't enough space, so I got out of a lot of it that way. But if we think of what the intent of all of this is, to use the fact that we would not be in this world at all if it were not for our mothers and fathers, and then broaden it up and say we would not be the way we are now were it not for all of the people that we meet, including the people in government, and the people whom we might think of as being nothing at all. They do the street sweeping and that kind of stuff. It's very important. I mean, all of this is there's no job which isn't important. The people on BART and so forth, and say, thank you for doing all of this to help me. Maybe you didn't know that you were helping me specifically, but you were. And so changing our attitude into gratitude, as we say in some of the 12-step programs, then say, rather than say, well, I've got to get all these people in the way, I just hate all these people in the way, say, these are all helping me. They're all, if they are not physically my mother, they have been in some sense, and they are nurturing me in some way or another. And sometimes they may be nasty to me, mean to me, but they're just having a bad day. And the bad day might last, the bad day might be lasting a lifetime, but it's still just a bad day. So that's how we can reframe this, I think. I offer that to you. Thank you. I think we have some time for questions. I hope I stopped soon enough for that. Yes.
5 minutes.
5 minutes for questions, yes.
And yet, in the Buddha's own life, he walked out on his father, mother, wife, and child.
Yes, that's true. In fact, I regret I wasn't able to go to it, but a couple of years ago at our big academic conference in the Buddhist section, I saw a paper title, "Was the Buddha a Deadbeat Dad?" And I regret I couldn't go to that to find out what the answer was. The way it's done around is that he... See, this also happens in China, too, that first of all, you must be filial to your parents, and you must do the ancestor rites. But also, you can become a monk or nun, because everybody is your mother and father. And you're helping them in a larger way when you do this. So, when the Buddha became a Buddha and then came back to his home, his wife, according to this tradition, was still living. There are other traditions that she died, but she's still living. And she had a son, Rahula, which means the fetter or chain, so he wasn't too pleased apparently with that. And she won't go out to meet him. She says, I'm not going to meet that guy. And she sends the son out and said, you're supposed to be a prince, and look what your father did. He went off to the forest. So you go and ask him, give me my inheritance, huh? So he goes, and the Buddha says, I will give you the Dharma, the robe and the bowl. And he makes him a monk, becomes a monk. And that is... In a larger context, that is being truly filial, because then, although it's good to be born of parents because we get a lifetime, in a sense it's bad because we're born into samsara, into suffering. So that's not an answer to your question. It shows the tension that there is in the Buddhist tradition, I think. So thank you for bringing that up. One more question? Yes.
Also, the big emotional element that the Buddha had to have life, supposedly after he was enlightened also, according to a book which one of our members, David Holmes, sort of reviewed for us one Sunday, because the Buddha's mother died in giving birth to him,
yes.
He never ever removed that wound.
Yes.
And had an
yes.
emotional life that was, you know, grieving just as much as anyone, even after. And
yes.
also, he asserts that the Buddha's wife, that they sort of got back together after he was enlightened and became very socially active, like almost a political.
Uh, there are different traditions about that. That's another way of going about it. Yes, the idea that the Buddha would be unemotional, I don't know where that actually came from, and I don't know why there had to be a book to redress the balance. It's pretty damn obvious. Buddha in the Tibetan, the Tibetan translation is in two parts, Sangye, and one part means to come awake or to come to after having been asleep or drunk. And suddenly, this is what it's all about, is it? And the other half is to come to full flowering. So a Buddha is not less than an ordinary individual with feelings, but more than. And the difference, I would say, is that they're not egocentric. They're not, I love you so much, I'm going to keep you forever, and nobody will get you. But that a Buddha is said to love all beings like a mother loves her only child. So this extremely warm aspect of the Buddha, which has been somehow lost in the West, and so we had to have a book to do it. About the grieving thing too, the Dalai Lama was once speaking to somebody, and he said that he realized at one point that he had said something when he was a young boy or young man to some monk, which had been so had hit the other monk so badly that he'd been criticized by the Dalai Lama that he killed himself. And so the interviewer, who was a psychologist, said, well, how did you process that? How did you deal with that? He says, I don't deal with that. It's very bad. See, so he just sits with it. This was a bad thing that happened. And don't say, well, it happened in the past, and I get rid of it. I'm going to process it, you know.
We have to stop here. Thanks, Roger. All right. Anyone else has questions? Will you be welcome to entertain you?
Yes, I will.
Here afterwards?
Yes.
Okay. one thing is that a special announcement is that next week Jim Wilson is. Making his last talk. Did you want to make an announcement about that?
Well, yeah, I would. Some of you are fairly new or brand new to GVF, but for us grizzled veterans, Jim has been just bedrock for this group. He's been our spiritual leader for years, and he's had a very special role in the history and continuation of GVF. And he's just a fantastic, enlightened person as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, after many years of talking once a month, the first Sunday of the month, it's just no longer possible for him to do that, so this is going to be his last one. And we'd like to give him, GVF would like to give him a nice, really nice gift before he goes. One idea is, I'll put my bad and white thing out. You have to look at it in detail. It's a hand-carved Tibetan altar, traveling altar. It means you can pick folds up too, and it's done by this Tibetan guy who's a woodcarver who learned it back in Tibet. It's a nice gift, but it's not a cheap gift. And so I think we have a couple of donors who've been making a big donation, and we have hopefully the GBF offers to cough up something, but. Hopefully, if you feel moved, make a donation to an appreciation for what Jim has done for his group, the Sangha. You can see me afterwards, and I would be glad to include that in the kitty. You can see these closer up, too. Okay. I do have another totally unrelated announcement, since I've got the floor. We're going to have another GBF Thanksgiving, this time over at Marty Cole's place. Beautiful, spacious place. Marty's been kind enough to offer this place up. So, traditionally, the Thanksgiving dinners have been very nice. So a lot of us have family elsewhere, and we're not going to spend our Thanksgiving going back to those families. And so this is a nice way for GBN members who want to go out to their families to spend some time celebrating everything they have to be thankful for. And it's a great blast. It's a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun every year. I think it's going to continue this year, too.
Okay. And next week, we're going to have a steering committee meeting. And there's only five people on the steering committee, which is pretty minimal. And there's always a flow in and out of the steering committee. So if you've been coming, you know, for a while, you know, people, you know, almost everybody, half the people here or more have worked for the, in one way or another, to keep the organization together. And that's the only way we stay together. So the steering committee, there's nothing tricky about it. There's actually four meetings a year because two of the, we decided to do it every other month, and then for two of those 6 months, they're all fellowship meetings and they're not steering committee meetings. So it's only four meetings a year, but we really need to have them to maintain the illusion that we're a together group. So I make light of it, but it's really important because the people on it now, including myself, have been working on it for a long time. And as I said, it's not a lifetime assignment, okay? So, you know, if you wanted to volunteer and you could just come to four meetings, which would be a year's worth, that would be very, very helpful. Cass, you got some host announcements?
Yes, I guess there's several things. There'll be tea and refreshments after the meeting, so anybody can stay and enjoy the fellowship. And if you do have tea, please wash your cup. There's also a town. Opportunity to donate to the organization. We suggest a donation of $5 if you can, if that's necessary.
There's also a sign up sheet. Byron, I don't know out there if you want to get on the email list and just let us know.
Yeah, and a lot of people are getting the. I guess we go to the website for the newsletter if we want. If we don't want a hard copy. Are people going to the website? We're not getting mailed.
If you want to set up for an automatic reminder of the newsletter being delivered to the news group, then you can go to Yahoo and go to Gay Buddhist Fellowship and sign up for that group. And then once when the newsletter lands, if you set up for just special notices, then you get just mail that says that if you want to participate in the news group, then it sets up like a normal Yahoo e-group. But to get the newsletter electronically, you don't have to sign up for anything. You can go to the website for the news group and go to the respective file sections and download it.
Okay.
Steve?
I do the snail mail for the group, so. There's lots of flyers in places like Spirit Rock and Berkeley Zen Center that I've placed out on the table with the reclining Buddha. And if you see something that attracts your attention or you know someone that would be interested, please feel free to take it because it was trashed otherwise.
Oh, yeah, thanks for inviting me. Some of you may know the teacher Sharon Salzberg. She's speaking in Berkeley tomorrow night. And I've been helping the Buddhist Peace Fellowship this year with media relations, and they gave me two comp tickets for it. And the person who I asked to go with me hasn't responded, and it's so I'm not. If someone, I mean, I think the fee is minimal, and I don't think they would turn you away. It's 25, and I don't think they would turn you away if you wanted to hear this really gifted teacher for lack of funds. On the other hand, if you wanted a complimentary ticket, you could talk to me afterwards. And if my friend, I'll call her again tonight. And if I can't get through to her, then I'll call her. But she's a. Has anyone ever heard her speak? I've never heard her speak. Anyone ever heard Sharon speak? She's a big member of a big teacher in this community. Okay, Roger, do you want to? close with some sort of benediction as we hold hands?
All right.
Oh, sorry. Something else, thank
you. Roger, you can't go without speaking of your Thursday night.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. This is a commercial. And we'll get back to our regularly scheduled program in a minute. I've just started last Thursday. We've got three more Thursdays at MCC in San Francisco. Some of you may know that they have a meeting on Monday evenings called Q Sangha, which is a Thich Nhat Hanh group. And the group is not just a Buddhist group that meets at MCC. It's an official part of MCC outreach because the person doing it is referred to as the Minister for Buddhist Spirituality at MCC. So this Buddhist-Christian thing is happening. And in connection with that, I'm giving a short course of four sessions on Buddhist and Christian practice on Thursday nights at MCC, room 108, from 7 to 8:30. And we ask for a donation, if you can afford it. The church has suggested $20 per session, but no one is turned away for lack of funds. So I'd be happy to see you there. Thank you. May all beings be separated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings be joined to happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings dwell in equanimity with those who are near and those who are far. May all beings find peace, joy, and freedom. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.